KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Dave Beck. In 1988, nobody in Brett Stafford's family knew how much he was struggling. When he committed suicide, his family couldn't talk about what happened or why. Kim Stafford is Brett's younger brother and a Portland-based writer. He made himself talk about what happened, in part because he missed his brother.
We were like twins. We did everything together. We literally would stumble along with our arms over each other's shoulders, singing, "We're pals, we're pals." I mean, it was almost a caricature of harmony among these two young beings. And we never fought, we never raised our voices, we never seemed to be in conflict. You know, and later I've wondered about, is that healthy? I mean, can one grow up? Can one have a true relationship without some friction? But we didn't have it then.
Mm-hmm. I love this charming little exchange that you would have with each other. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, part of the custom, our parents told us, it's time for bed, we're going to turn out the light, and we would say, is it okay if we still whisper and sing? Say, yeah, for a while. So they'd go back to the living room, and they'd be doing their adult things of, you know, reading boring magazines and things like that. And my brother and I would whisper and sing, which meant we would pretend to be a record player, one of us. And, you know, the other would say, put the needle down, and then we made the sound of the needle, and then we'd sing a song. And at the end, when the needle goes to the center of the record, the singer then would say, bottom, bottom, bottom. That's the end of the record. Okay, take the needle off. So we'd have these little games that involved singing and telling stories and so on. And then as we began to get sleepy, we had a little blessing we'd worked out. We were probably 5 and 6 years old at this point, where one of us would say, good night, God bless you, have sweet dreams, see you tomorrow. And then the other one would repeat that, and that meant the day is over, officially, that we can rest, we're safe, we have given a blessing. And we kept saying that to each other. This sounds fantastic, Dave, but through high school, every night we would say this formula, very speeded up. We probably couldn't decipher it, but it was a landmark as everything around us was changing, you know, our bodies and the world and our responsibilities. We had this connection.
What happened to him?
Yeah, he was a land use planner, and as one of his friends said to me recently, he should have been a holy man, not a land use planner. So it was a job with a lot of friction, a lot of people angry at him, very, very conflict-based on a daily basis. And he suffered so much, he finally quit his job. He sold his house. He moved his family way up north into Canada, about 600 miles north of the border, to a tiny town. And out of sight from the rest of the family, he began to disintegrate there. He went into a depression. He stopped sleeping, sort of unconnected from the moorings of a job and a place and a community. He just fell apart. And he tried to take his life up there, and we didn't know that. You know, he was that far away. And so he came to Oregon. I was helping him. He wanted to get a job back in the Northwest, back in Oregon. And I was helping him find a job, and he went to a couple job interviews, and he was just catatonic, the people there told me later. They could hardly get a word out from him. He was so shut down. And he went to my sister's house. He was there alone. He found a pistol, and he shot himself. And she found him. And, you know, he was 40 years old. We were so naive as a family. We didn't recognize the intensity of his suffering. So it caught us very much by surprise.
Mm-hmm. Silence is something, whether it was your own silence or the silence of your family, which you've alluded to, and particularly your father, how you saw your father deal with this.
Yeah, when my brother died, our father went into his study, closed the door, and read Wordsworth. and went through his own struggle and trial and, you know, got back to some kind of neutrality about it. And when he came out of that room, he wouldn't talk about my brother. He was sort of falsely cheerful. He was obviously crushed, by it, utterly crushed. And he resorted to a kind of a distancing from it. He couldn't sit with us at the memorial service. When people came to console us, he would change the subject and, you know, act jolly. It was pathetic. He was helpless. He was so slain by this event.
And then there's the juxtaposition of the idea that your father would say, let's talk recklessly about something. I mean, of course, you don't want to talk recklessly about suicide, but he was so open or so willing to engage deeply in
ideas.
Yeah,
our dad, this was part of the irony of the whole situation. Our dad was the great writer. You know, every day he was famous for writing a poem every day. And when he would announce, let's talk recklessly, that was a great invitation to, you know, gossip and stories and questions and ask anything. And so the utter difference between that sort of musical tone in the household and the silence about my brother was very disorienting. And I had a strange recognition the other day, Dave, that my father's paralysis forced me to grow up. You know, after that time, I couldn't rely on my father anymore, and I didn't have my brother. So I was forced to become responsible for what I did after that.
And I suppose part of that responsibility was telling the story. And even if it was in kind of defiance of the family that couldn't really talk about it for 20 years.
Yeah, maybe some of our listeners will relate to this. You know, if you decide I am the one who's going to tell the story, that's like a declaration of war with the family, in a way. You get a lot of pushback. And in my case, when I was writing this, I would be thinking, well, I can't say that. I better leave that out. And, you know, I better negotiate and so on. And then at a certain point, I realized, wait a minute. I'm doing the work of the family. This is the work that has to be done. This story has to be understood. These memories have to be talked about. I'm carrying out responsible action as an act of love for an injured family.
You speak of it there, but how do you go forward now in a profoundly different way 25 years after your brother's passing?
You know, one thing that started happening the day of my brother's death, I had heard this phrase in church, you know, the veil will be pulled away from your eyes and you'll see the Creator face to face. And this idea of a veil being pulled away, I think part of growing up, a part of growing up in a way you can only grow up through a violent event like this, is the veil is pulled away and you suddenly are able to see the suffering in the eyes of other people. I felt from that day forward and more when I walk down the street, I'm not just surrounded by people. I'm surrounded by stories. I'm surrounded by suffering. I feel we go forth participating in the suffering of the world. And, you know, that's not just attrition. That's an opportunity to engage and help people. I think before my brother's suicide, I was a child. I drifted along. Happy and sad myself, but, you know, not telling about the sad part because we don't want to be sad together. We want to celebrate. And so when I was sad, I would hide, and I would hide my suffering. And I didn't see the suffering of others. And now I feel I'm on a different wavelength with people.
I asked at the beginning what your relationship was to your brother, and then we explored it at the time of the suicide. What is it now? Who is he now, and how does he come to you?
He's my spiritual companion. You know, he's my my listener. Often in writing class, I ask people to make a list of the best listeners in their life. And you know, if there's a piece of writing I'm struggling with, I can't get what it's really about, or maybe there's something I'm hiding even from myself, I'll sometimes do a draft addressed to my brother as if a letter. You know, dear Brett, at work today, when my boss made me feel small, I didn't know how to go forward. Tell me, what should I do? You know, and then I'll answer in his voice. Mm. Well, you are who you are. The fact that he can't see you doesn't mean anything about you. And, you know, so he's, maybe this sounds silly or contrived, but it doesn't feel that way. He's like a completely honest dimension of myself now. We're still pals. I still rely on him. I still reach out to him.
Kim Stafford is an author and professor at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Kim's new memoir about his brother's suicide is called 100 Tricks Every Boy Can Do, How My Brother Disappeared. You can find out more at KUOW.org. I'm Dave Beck, KUOW 94.9.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.